This podcast is In the Loop, the Legion of Osiris podcasts. Osiris is creating a community that connects people like you with live experiences and podcasts about artists and topics you love. Get in the loop at osirispod.com.
I'm Bob Crawford, and this is The Road to Now. Over the past 5 years, Ben and I have been honored to welcome some of the most important historians of our time to this show. This week is no different, and I'd like to say maybe more so, as we finally welcome Annette Gordon Reed to The Road to Now. This is something that Ben, I have to give Ben total credit, because we've been trying to get her on the show for a while, and Ben accomplished that task last week. And she was every bit as gracious, every bit as incisive and intelligent, and just such a warm, warm person and an incredible historian. So we're so excited. If you don't know who Annette Gordon Reed is, you are in for a real treat. She is the Carl M. Loeb University Professor at Harvard University, but she's also the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The Hemingses of Monticello. So I'm sure you've heard of that book, but we're here to talk with Annette this week about her current book, On Juneteenth. It's called On Juneteenth, and it's really unique. It's a memoir, and it's a historical account. So those are hard to write. And, you know, what's really incredible about her book is when I think about the moment we're in, no, we're not going to move forward together in agreement. I believe we're going to move forward together in disagreement. And how do we do that? And how do we do that peacefully? And I feel like something in On Juneteenth, there are clues for us in this book of how we absorbed the uglier moments of our history into the myth of our history. You know, this idea that Juneteenth and July 4th they complement each other. They're opposite sides of the same coin. So anyway, great conversation. Wonderful guest. We're so happy that she was so gracious with her time, and you're going to love the show. On a personal note, I will be taking off after next week until the 1st of August. We have our daughter's medical appointments coming up, and then back on the road. The band is finally back on the road, and also family vacation. So God willing, I'll be with you all again in early August. In the meantime, Ben will have some incredible shows that he's been working on, and he'll have great guests, and the quality, as you know, will just continue to be top-notch. So I wish you all safe travels this summer. I wish you the best of health. Enjoy re-entering the world, as we're all doing these days. Without further ado, Annette Gordon Reed.
Annette Gordon Reed, welcome to The Road to Now.
Glad to be here.
It is an honor to have you here. Bob and I have had you as one of those like top lists, like one of the top people on the list for a while, where it's been like, let's contact Annette Gordon Reed. And just so having you here, it's been a while coming, and that it came at all is amazing to us. But we've got you here today. You wrote this magnificent book on Juneteenth. I mean, I use the word stunning to describe it. That's not a word I use very often, but I felt like every once in a while the word fits perfectly. It's a stunning book. It tells the story of Juneteenth, but it tells the story of your life. And so for a lot of people who are listening now, they may have heard of Juneteenth. It's starting to become something that people are catching wind of. Could you explain the origins of that holiday and how it's progressed in the last few years?
Well, thank you. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for your kind words. Juneteenth commemorates the day, June 19th, 1865, when Gordon Granger, a general in the United States Army, came to Galveston and announced that slavery was over in Texas. This was a couple of years after the Emancipation Proclamation had been proclaimed. It was a few months after Lee had surrendered at Appomattox, which is what most people think of as the end of the Civil War, because the Army of Northern Virginia obviously was the most important army and under the leadership of Lee. But the Army in the Southwest kept fighting. The Army of the Trans-Mississippi kept fighting, and they did not surrender until the beginning of June, the first week of June. And that was why Granger and the Union Army and his soldiers were able to go to Galveston and say that slavery was over in Texas, because they laid down their arms and the Union Army was in control of that area. So it wasn't just a matter, sometimes this is portrayed as if this was a secret that was being kept from, the Emancipation Proclamation was a key secret being kept from enslaved people in Texas. That really wasn't it. It's that the fighting wasn't over. And the Union could not take or did not take control of that area until that moment. And that's the origin of the holiday. I am a native Texan, so I grew up celebrating this day. People say it is the longest continuous celebration of an Emancipation Day. There are some people who dispute that and say other areas, you know, the sort of regional pride said, well, you know, we celebrated Richmond. April 3rd, I guess, in Virginia, they do that. And Emancipation Day in Boston, January 1st, and linking it to the Emancipation Proclamation. But Juneteenth is the holiday that Black Texans celebrated from the very beginning. And when Texans left Texas and went other places, they took the holiday with them and said, you know, well, we should celebrate this here, even though we're not in Texas anymore. And that's how it spread across the country. But in the past, I would say, I've just noticed, this is anecdotal on my part. I mean, I've noticed in the past decade, the holiday has taken off. And in fact, I think all but about three or four states have some form of recognition of it, commemoration of it. So in the last 2 years, I'm told that social media mentions of Juneteenth, social media has transformed so many things. And it's done the same with Juneteenth. It's become much more widespread and more people know about it than knew about it when I was growing up in Texas, celebrating it with my family.
I think those of us who love American history and study it and we want to embrace it, but there's so much ugliness about it, right? It's, I always say the good, the bad, and the ugly of American mm-hmm. history, right? Mm-hmm. And the deeper you get into it, the uglier it can be. Mm-hmm. And then it makes these things like July 4th, it makes you reassess July 4th and the way we celebrate it and what does it really mean. And it seems like Juneteenth is giving us the wider acceptance and knowledge of Juneteenth is giving us kind of a way it kind of completes July 4th in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah. Oh, I think so. It's definitely a compliment. When I was a kid, it was sort of a 1-2 punch for picnic oriented things and firecrackers and soda pop, soda water, as we called it, and fun. But it really does stand as, you know, sort of a cautionary, a rebuke is maybe a rebuke, or certainly it gives you pause about July 4th and you have to see them together. The promise of July 4th is supposed to be contained within June 19th. And even General Granger's order talks about absolute equality, that a state of absolute equality that was now going to exist after the end of slavery. He's sort of referencing the Emancipation Proclamation, referencing the Declaration that equality is supposed to be part of the basic creed in American life. Now, we know that creed, that is your suggesting, Bob, that this wasn't realized, obviously, and is still not fully realized. But yeah, I think those days work together. Juneteenth offers an opportunity to interrogate the fourth a bit.
You write in your book that all the currents of American history run through Texas. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about mm-hmm. that for a second?
Well, I was thinking about it. It's the only state where you have all of the sort of major flashpoints, major things that, you know, we consider to be a part of American history going through it. We think of slavery. Well, you might start with the conflict between indigenous people, Indians and Anglo settlers, slavery, plantation slavery, Jim Crow after the end of slavery, the Latino Anglo relationships, the state borders a foreign country. And so immigration is a problem, you know, is an issue that we've been dealing with for a long time. And so I can't think of any other state where you have all of that together. And strangely enough, the state that is seen, as I say in the book, has been constructed as a white man and a white area. People think about cowboys and oil men, even though cowboys, there are a lot of black cowboys, but Hollywood, you know, you won't know that from movies, but that's the image of it. But here's this state that from the very beginning was this multicultural place. And people think of it as largely white. So when issues boil up or boil over as they're doing now on the questions of voter suppression and what can be taught in schools, it may surprise some people because they don't realize that these tensions have always been there from the very beginning, because it's always been a diverse and contentious place.
The thing that I find fascinating about your book, taken as a whole, right? And for those listening, you've got to read this book. I mean, it was over before I knew I started it. And I went back and read portions of it, and I've already got notes in it about what I'm going to assign next semester. And I don't know if anybody coming out of this last year teaching online, you're not thinking about next semester if you can help it. You're just like, dear Lord, give me a couple months off.
I know. I just turned in grades today.
Oh, God bless you. But the thing that strikes me throughout this book is that it's a story of you as well. Mm-hmm. And you know, this hit me. I was sitting down, like, read the book and reread parts of it. And as I was writing down, I realized there's this phrase, don't meet your heroes, right? Never meet your heroes. And it occurred to me that, like, that's part of your story, is that you come up, in spite of this dark part of Texas history, you come up a proud Texan. And mm-hmm. you have the same heroes as a little girl. The mm-hmm. same larger than life figures in your life that white Texans have in a way that a lot of Americans wouldn't expect. But then you get into getting to know them with your study of history. And could you talk about that process, and particularly about the movie The Alamo and how that changed the way you saw things?
Well, I went to see The Alamo, the version, I guess it was 1960, and they re-released it at the end of the 1960s. And I went to see it when it was re-released in Texas, and I went with a friend of mine. And as I say in the book, I knew all of these people, Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, William Travis. These are the names of schools I went to, after the movie, I went to William Travis Junior High School, and there was a Crockett and so forth. So we knew all of these people were supposed to be heroes of Texas, and they stood for valor and bravery and standing on your principles. But I never really thought about, because I had no reason to think about, because I didn't make the connection between their desire to break away from Mexico and create a Republic of Texas, that desire, and the desire to maintain a system of slavery. Mexico had outlawed slavery. They were sort of looking a different way, looking the other way with slavery and among Anglos in Texas. But the Texians were always a bit insecure about what would happen, you know, if Mexico ever decided to get serious about their anti-slavery stance. I mean, and there were other issues as well. I mean, Santa Ana suspended the Constitution. There's a different culture, a different language. So it would be hard for them to have stayed in the fold for forever anyway. But slavery was a major part of the concern that they had. So how do I, as a Black person, when I basically find this out as a teenager and know more about it in depth as a young adult, what am I supposed to think about something like the Alamo when I know that those heroes were among them slave owners, some of them, and slave traders, Bowie and you know, Crockett, and all these people were involved in slavery one way or another. So, you know, there's the general principles that they were fighting for. There's the notion of bravery and valor, but it's what are those principles? What were the specifics of them? And I just had to come to some sort of different way of thinking about them. The way you, when you discover that people you have admired or people that you've been told are heroes, that they have flaws. And it's being mature about it, to understand that the world is complicated, human beings are flawed, and human beings do bad things. And sometimes we admire people who, if you dig a little bit, you find out that they're more problematic than you thought. It's interesting. The other day, at the big fight that's going on down there now about voter suppression when the Democrats walk out, and one of them said, this is the Alamo. I mean, they used the metaphor of the Alamo to describe what, you know, the last stand that they were making. So, it's you take the individual people out of it. And it's not about the personalities of the individual folks. It's this notion of going up against overwhelming odds, but being determined that you were going to go for it. So I thought that was actually quite ironic to see what, you know, that they would invoke that. But that's a very Texan kind of thing to do, and strange given the actual facts and the details about it. But maybe the thinking is the details don't really matter. It's the idea is that we're gonna go to the end on this in fighting, and knowing that that will appeal to their fellow Texans.
One of the things about that story that I really loved in my class, and just generally the way I talk about history, it's there's the silence and the noise. There's what we say, and then there's what we just don't say. Mm-hmm. And you, one of the things that really got me that I thought this was like perfect was there's a scene in the movie where the line is drawn in the sand, and mm-hmm. everyone who wants to leave can leave. Mm-hmm. And the people, and then some people stay on the side of the line, some people walk over it. And we're like, well, everyone there who died knew what they were getting themselves into. And you say, mm-hmm. yeah, that's true, unless you count the enslaved people who did not have a choice, who had to stay mm-hmm. there with mm-hmm. the white folks who claimed ownership over them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there's a lot to unpack with all of this. And I understand why some people don't want to do it, because it's painful. You know, to find out, it's like these are people that are like friends. You don't know these people, obviously, but you grow up with them as people whom you're supposed to admire, and you find out that they had values that are antithetical to the values we hold today. So how do you bring them forward? Do you bring them forward? And that's partly what I think is a big part of what we're fighting about, what they're fighting about down there now, people who are doing the interpretation, who don't want the interpretation of the Alamo to talk about slavery or to talk about these other issues. But the problem is, you know, you can't, if you read the Constitution of the Republic of Texas, you have to deal with it. This is not a question of interpretation. We're not interpreting something here. This is, it's there. Race, slavery, all those things are in that primary document. So how can you teach it without having people read the Constitution of the Republic of Texas?
It's funny, when I was reading your book and making notes for today, something I wrote and then circled it was, there's always a backlash. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. we, of course, there was a backlash to order number three, is it? Was that mm-hmm. Granger's order number three? Yeah. There was a backlash to that, mm-hmm. a backlash to Reconstruction, a backlash mm-hmm. To civil rights, a backlash to the election of Barack Obama, and we're seeing a backlash today to, I guess, Donald Trump losing the 2020 election. Right? There's a that's what this is all about.
Mm-hmm. And you know, and the huge, not only losing, I mean that, but the huge increase, the number of people who came out to vote. And showing people want to vote. If you don't put obstacles in their way, people, and it's sort of a strange thing, a nutty thing to think of, that in a republic, eligible voters want to vote. I mean, that's what it's supposed to be about. And once that was made possible, people came out in droves. So what you're seeing is a backlash against the greater participation of actually on both sides of the aisle, among Democrats and Republicans. People came out to vote, and that some people are frightened of that idea.
There might be a backlash to the backlash.
Yeah, I think, you know, I think there will be. I can't see putting that genie back in the bottle, you know, with people understanding that they actually have a shot at changing things. Because the mantra before was, oh, my vote doesn't count. Voting doesn't matter. It mattered a lot in the last election. And I think people have seen that. So I'm hopeful, you know, that there will be people will continue to make their last stands or whatever is necessary to try to ensure that people who are eligible to vote are allowed to do that without impediment.
My response to people who have said that their vote doesn't count would be, I've always responded, if your vote doesn't count, then why do people work so hard to keep you from doing it?
Yeah, it's true. When I was growing up, my parents used to say that the polling place in Black neighborhoods changed with every election, and the polling places for whites pretty much stayed the same place. So everybody would know where to go to vote. But, you know, for Black people, and depending upon where you live, they had to, in every election, it's like, okay, where do we go to vote now? And that, I don't think, was a coincidence.
Well, so you write about your parents in this book and mm-hmm. the decisions they made for you. As far as going to school during, I guess, or before integration in Texas, there was mm-hmm. a free choice plan, mm-hmm. I guess, for schooling. Can you talk about that? Because you don't only write about history, you don't only study it, but you were history to some extent in your community.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was about 10 years after Brown versus Board of Education struck down, said that separate but equal was schools were inherently inferior and ordered desegregation of the schools, the Brown cases together. And there were a number of jurisdictions, not just in Texas, but found ways to try to get around it. I mean, aside from just leaving altogether and forming private academies and going to these schools, but in the public school system, the idea was to come up with a way around it. And that was something called the Freedom of Choice Plan, which meant that white parents were going to choose white schools for their kids, and Black parents would choose Black schools for their children. My parents decided when I was going into the first grade, I'd been in kindergarten at Booker T. Washington School, which was the K-12 Black school in my town, where my mother taught, incidentally. And they decided that I would start first grade real school. In those days, kindergarten was, you know, I was an afternoon kid, and you go there and you drink, you know, have graham crackers and juice and, you know, learn the alphabet. And I mean, very low key in those days. It's all about social, learning how to not bite people or hit people, learning how to live with other people. So they decided once I was going to real school that I would go to Anderson. So I integrated our town school, our school district. My parents and the papers, everybody, the adults in the room decided that they wouldn't make a big deal about it, that I would not be escorted into the school, even though I learned later on that there had been some threats to my family. So there may have been people around, officers around somewhere, but I doubt it. But it was supposed to be low key. And my father took me to school and dropped me off, and it was supposed to proceed normally. And for the most part, it did, except I do recall people coming to visit the class, you know, standing in the doorway, looking in to sort of see, you know, this situation with a Black student among white students.
And there. Were you conscious that was you? Were you conscious?
Oh, yes. Well, absolutely. I knew they were there to watch me and to watch them and to see what was, you know, what was supposed to be happening here. And so there was a sense from an early on of being on display because I understood that this was a big deal. My parents had communicated that to me in a way, in a quiet way, but not in a way that was alarming in any kind of way. But it was, you know, this was something different that I was doing. And I was very much aware of that. And I think, you know, my first grade teacher, Mrs. Daughtry, who I guess we all remember the names of our first grade teachers, was wonderful. It was great. And I think that after I wrote the book, it occurred to me that maybe I don't wonder if the fact that I was the daughter of a teacher, that there may have been some sense of camaraderie there, maybe extra looking out for kind of thing. But she was wonderful. Some of the kids were great. Some of them were not. There were people who I think maybe their parents specifically told them to be nice to me. But others, it was sort of the opposite tack that they took. I was a good student, so I think that made things easy. I'm a pretty even-tempered person, and so I didn't cause any problems, and there was only one of me. So things went pretty well to begin with. And then 3 years later, the Supreme Court struck down the freedom of choice plans, and everybody had to switch schools. And that engendered a lot of hostility among some Black people in the town, because, you know, not to romanticize segregation, but Booker T. Washington was a special school for the community. It was the sort of nerve center, the center of the community. Black teachers were role models, along with ministers. Obviously, there were more of them, and they, you know, they lived in the community. The kids knew them. Sometimes their parents socialized together. So school, I mean, the community was an extension of the school in a way that I don't think that kind of connection I didn't have with my teachers, no matter how wonderful they were and kind to me. They didn't live in my community. They didn't socialize with, as far as I know, certainly didn't socialize with my parents or other people that I knew. So there was always, we were, and I say in the book, we were Texans, but our experience as Texans had been subdivided by race, the sort of boundaries that were put in place. And, you know, it made for a different kind of circumstance. So there was, I think, you know, some resentment. Well, I think I know some resentment on the part of Black members of the Black community at the sort of loss of that. I mean, they appreciated not having to go to separate waiting rooms or sit in the balcony when you go to the movie. I mean, there those kinds of social things. But there's always a gain and loss in these circumstances. And another loss was the removal, you know, throughout the South. In many communities of Black teachers. So when people think about integration, they think about the kids. They don't think about, you know, what about the integration of the power structure, of the administration, of teaching and so forth. And that didn't go as well as, well, integration didn't go that well in many places, but it wasn't as smooth as in some places as the integration of children. It was easier. Because people, didn't want to give up power, and it was not a power sharing kind of thing.
Everyone listening, do you drink coffee? Yes. Yes, you do. I'm the only person who doesn't drink coffee very frequently. And I know that everyone else does because everyone else goes, why don't you drink coffee? Well, for those of you guys who
why don't you drink coffee?
This is the only coffee I drink anymore. It's La Cosecha coffee, Bob. La Cosecha.
Great coffee.
That's right. I'm proud to say that we've had a sponsorship with them for a while. I have bags of their coffee here. And if you're ever stuck inside and you want to have some great way to start off your day, what better than having a good, nice cup of coffee?
I had bags of La Cosecha coffee, but I drink 3 pots of coffee a day, and it went really quick.
Yeah. Well, if you drink a lot of coffee, that means you need to keep ordering it. And here's the beautiful thing. For those of you guys who are drinking coffee to get through the day, drinking coffee to get up in the morning, drinking coffee for any reason, and you want a good cup, you can drink that coffee, support a small business that does good work and trade, does fair trade and takes care of the people that they work with. They have direct relationships with their farmers that they buy the beans from, and they do a fantastic job. La Cosecha Coffee Roasters. That's LACOSECHACOFFEE, LaCosechaCoffee.com. Go to their website, help out this small business, get yourself some good coffee. And if you enter promo code, the letters RTN and the number 10, that's RTN10, you can get 10% off your coffee and you can feel good about drinking it as you get stronger. Bob, does coffee make you stronger?
I think it makes you smarter.
Hmm. What do you?
I'm sorry.
It's all right. So you're basically like, I've just been trying to figure out why he's not very smart. And the coffee is.
I didn't say that. You asked me a question. I answered.
That's fine.
Honestly.
No, that's an acceptable answer. I can't tell you what to say, Bob, but I can say that you should go to LaCosechaCoffee.com and order some La Cosecha coffee. Our man, Jamie Jeske out there holding the fort down. We got to keep our small businesses going and we love them. So LaCosechaCoffee.com, promo code RTN and the number 10 and order some coffee. We did an episode last summer that was hosted by my colleague, Lewis Woods. We aired it in July. It's called I Can't Breathe. And we called it past the mic. We gave it to him and he interviewed some of, you know, he's a black scholar. He interviewed some of his friends in different fields. And he interviewed Tara Vincent Chambers, who is an educational specialist. And she talked about this. An entire generation of black teachers just very quickly removed from the classrooms because you might have to deal with the integration of students, but white parents were not going to deal by and large with black teachers. And that this was devastating because in black communities, the two places that excellence was permitted by white society was, mm-hmm. it was with preachers and with teachers. Mm-hmm. And your mother experienced that, right? But your mother was able to maintain her work, right?
Yeah. Yeah, she stayed in the classroom. My mother was a very good teacher and very good planner, and she wrote lots of lessons plans for the administration before black people could actually go into administration. And that's changed now. There are black principals in Conroe. There are all kinds of things, but during her time period, that was not the case. And so, yeah, the loss of role models, and not just for black students, but for white students, it would be important for white students to be under the tutelage of black people and see them as authority figures and figures with expertise. And that was one of the reasons I think my parents became a bit disillusioned, who had been idealistic at the beginning, became a little disillusioned with integration because it was not done. You know, I've said, it's like Blackstone says about the husband and the wife, the two become one and the one is him. And this is, it was black and white mixed together and it's white people. And now everybody, that's no bringing black culture into it or interests. And so it was a bittersweet kind of thing. It certainly made the social life less tense every day. You know, if you're having encounters with storekeepers who were mean-spirited, or you could sit where you wanted to in the movie theater. But that was a real loss.
You talk about the violence and you and your family members and family members who didn't live in Conroe being afraid of coming to Conroe because of violence that they knew had occurred. You tell mm-hmm. the story of Bob White.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. But Bob White, the story of Bob White, that is known in lots of places in Texas. He, strangely enough, the two cities that are featured in this story are the city where I was born, Livingston, the city, oh my goodness, the town where I was born, and Conroe, the place where I grew up. The crime, the alleged crime, he was accused of raping a white woman. And, you know, the interesting thing about this is that my grandfather used to talk to me about this, talk to us about this. And his story was that he knew Bob White and he knew the Cochrans, the couple who were involved in this. And he was saying that they were going together, that was, and that he talked about it very foolishly, Bob White. But in any event, so he's arrested for rape. The Texas Rangers take him out in the woods every night and beat him until he confesses. And he confesses. He has a trial. He's sentenced to death in the electric chair for rape, which was allowable then. And his lawyers appeal. The case goes all the way. And I didn't know this until I was working on the book, that this case went all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the court determined that taking somebody out in the woods, tying them to a tree and beating them until they confess is in fact a violation of the due process clause of the 14th Amendment. Now, ironically, I teach criminal procedure in law school, and I talk about the due process and confession cases, but we use Brown v. Mississippi, a case. And I, you know, it's interesting. I could have had something from my hometown. The story, you know, a story that I had heard from the time that I was a child. And so they sent it back down for a new trial, and it sent back to a trial in Conroe, which was supposed to be better than Livingston, because it was just too prejudiced. People thought too many people knew the Cochrans and knew Bob White in Livingston. So they moved it to Conroe. And while he's on trial, Dude Cochran, that's his nickname, Dude Cochran, comes into the courtroom and shoots him and kills him in front of everybody, and then is acquitted in the trial that's held quickly after that. And everybody cheers and it's great. And so that episode, there had been lynchings in Conroe before. A person was burned at the stake on the courthouse steps in the 1920s. But this was just brutal for people. You understand extra legal violence. You know, you don't want to say you understand it, but you know that mobs, we know what mobs are going to do. But the idea that a person could shoot someone premeditated in a court in front of a judge and a jury and the prosecutor and the defense and spectators and walk, you know, is just, that just broke people. And members of my family, you know, would come to visit, but they wouldn't spend the night in Conroe. And I think it's not so much that I thought that they thought they were going to be attacked. I just think it was a protest. It was just, you know, this is not a place where I want to be. I want to lay my head and rest at night. So yeah, and that stuck with people because it was such, you think, as I was writing this and looking at going through these cases for the first time and understanding its procedural history, there must have been such hope, because at various stages courts were saying, okay, this is wrong, you know, we got it, you know, it kept going and going, and finally up to the Supreme Court that said, you know, this is, you can't treat people like this. And then to have it end that way was just heartbreaking for people. And it's hard to get rid of that. I mean, when something like that happens in a town, in a small place, also including the lynching and so forth, how do you get that out of the culture, the consciousness of people, some of whom were alive, you know, lived into the 60s and so forth? It was just, It was a defining moment for the town.
My family and I just came back from Montgomery, Alabama. I was mentioning this before. And we went to the Legacy Museum there. And I think one of the amazing things that place does, that space does, is it takes these stories that we like to separate ourselves from, these stories of lynchings and mob justice and slavery and brutality and all of this, and it puts them in a story, a narrative, and it puts that narrative up with us right now. And that is how the criminal justice system is reshaped in localities to recreate subjectivity And it was powerful in the way it did that. And I think it almost caught me off guard, but it's amazing how, like, after reading your book and being blown away by this story, like a week later, I walk into a museum and have to be blown away again by that same story. This gets at the question I want to ask you, because, you know, we spoke with Kim Burns a couple of months ago. We spoke with different people about this, which is going back to this meeting your heroes thing, right? Like, we live in this place where we love it, but we know the darkness in it. Now, my argument is that you can't really love if you don't know the darkness. You can fetishize, right? You can root for, but love only comes when you know the dark and light and you truly choose to love. Mm-hmm. And when I read your book, your story about growing up and your story about Texas, even to the point where recently you heard about people celebrating Juneteenth and you were like, no, that's ours. That's Texas. That's your first reaction. You say that in the very opening pages. How did you, as someone who knows so much about both the law and history, how do you find what is clearly still a love for a place that time and time again has broken our hearts?
Mm-hmm. Well, I love it because, and I talk a little bit about this, and I think it's really true. It's because where I met my family, the people who loved me and the people that I loved, I have great memories. I mean, Conroe has these problems, but, you know, I grew up riding my bike, playing with friends, having, you know, idyllic is not the word, but, you know, what you think of as a town, as a place where kids roam around together in groups, freely playing baseball, doing all the kinds of things that, you know, that kids do. And I enjoyed myself. I mean, it was not always good times, but it's because of the experiences that I have there, because of my mother, my father, my brothers, my grandparents. You know, that is my Texas, the experiences that I have on that land, in that place. And I don't think that I have to yield to the values, to the hostility maybe of other people who call themselves Texans and convince themselves that I don't belong there. I mean, they can have that view, but that's not my Texas. And I don't think that they own Texas any more than I do. I feel the same about the United States. And African-American people have had that attitude from the very, very beginning. We've been here forever. I mean, my family, on my mother's side, you know, looking at if ancestry.com is to be believed, actually the copies of the census records, photocopies of the census records, members of my mother's family were in Texas in the 1820s. And my father's family, at least since the 1860s, and most of us are there. So we are true. We were Texans before it was, a republic, before it was a state. And I don't think that other people's hostility or determination to say that I don't belong, to my mind, have no merit. You know, so I love it because that's where my family and my connections were. The first ones, how I learned to be whatever kind of person I am. And it was where I experienced my parents' hopes and my parents' work to raise me and, you know, bring me to adulthood. That's what it is. It's those associations that make the place for me, not what other people are saying about whether I belong or not.
You know, I think you get at something. Well, you know, there's this since Charlottesville, you know, really before Charlottesville, but then Charlottesville plus George Floyd's murder has led to, on the one hand, a rejection of the Confederacy, right, as a popular culture, if it's Dukes of Hazzard or if it's
they're just the chick,
right? Exactly. Lady Antebellum is lady, but yeah. but you know, we can argue about like well, we're going too far. Okay, take down that statue of Robert E. Lee. But what about that statue of Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln? And you know, we're just trying to figure this out, right? As a culture, we're trying to figure this out. But there's also now I didn't know anything about Juneteenth, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, I probably read something about it. I forgot about it. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about certainly didn't know about the massacre in Tulsa until last year. Mm-hmm. But now we do, mm-hmm. because of George Floyd in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah.
Is this how we're, like we talked about, like, well, July 4th, Juneteenth, let's make it a season. Like, is this how we're going to move forward? Is this how we're going to do it? We're going to bring in these, like, there wasn't always a Martin Luther King birthday celebration, you know, but now there is. And mm-hmm. now it's pretty widely accepted that you know, you do public service, you remember the man, you know. Mm-hmm. Is this how we're going to move forward?
Well, this is one way we will, that we have to move forward on a lot of different fronts. But I think this, I think that's a good idea to think about, you know, July 4th and Juneteenth together, and make sure that people who are historians, people, public historians, academic historians, popular, whatever, and journalists too, make sure that there is a serious conversation, that it's not just a you know, perfunctory, pro forma recognition of something. This is an opportunity for people to talk about these issues. And if you pair Juneteenth with July 4th and think about the unrealized promise of the United States of America, it could be really useful. I mean, I, you know, some people, I was talking to some people who, you know, were concerned that it's such an important holiday, they didn't want to see it cheapened by the kind of commercialism that we know is going to come to the fore. I mean, this is the United States of America. Things are going to be commercialized, you know, whether you want it or not, that's going to be a component of it. But just because there's that doesn't mean that this is not going to be the people who are really interested in this and people who care about this will not take the opportunity to talk about these connections, to talk about the day and what it meant, talk about the, some ways, the unrealized, well, not in some ways, but the unrealized promise of Juneteenth, this high water mark of optimism among people, and then later with Reconstruction. And then we know what happens after Reconstruction with the redemption governments that come in and, you know, bring in voter suppression and lynching and all those kinds of things, trying to maintain the racial hierarchy.
Tulsa, right? Yeah. Tulsa.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Tulsa, and Wilmington. And
I was going to say, I think the good thing about the Tulsa commemorations is that all of these things are opportunities for people to say, you know, what about Wilmington? What about these places? What about sundown towns in general? What about the research that people have done showing that, you know, you could go to, you know, to counties in some southern states that had Black people, and then 10 years later, they go back and look and they're gone. And you can look at newspapers. There's stories about how all of a sudden they just made all the Black people leave and took their property. I mean, this is an opportunity for opening the door. And I, what we were alluding to before, Bob, is I think a lot of people are frightened about that, you know, and Ben too, we're talking about denial, frightened about the prospect of, you know, of sort of upsetting a kind of rosy picture, a too rosy picture of the past. So, yeah, I think that this is one way forward, but there are lots of ways forward. But I think historians, people who are interested in these subjects, that this is the time, or whenever we have these commemorations, to speak up and raise the kinds of issues that we're talking about today. So it could be educational. It doesn't all have to be just, you know, commercialized and pro forma. It could be of value, and I hope that that's the direction all of this takes.
So there's the hope. Here's the fear. I really wish I would have done the fear first, to be honest with you. But Ben knows me so well. Right? And Bob's always going to be, here comes the fear.
Here comes the fear.
I'm parallel studying apartheid in South Africa. And so when I look at the direction of the United States and how we will be a white minority government, you know, 20, 30 years, you know, maybe sooner. And then looking at the voter restrictions that are coming into, I mean, I think January 6th, Trump, it's all like you said, trying to hold on to power, right? It's all mm-hmm. about looking in the future and realizing the Republican Party, looking at it saying, if we don't hold on to power now, we're going to lose it forever. And so now we have to do the things and institutionalize our stronghold, right, with our rules and laws. And the extreme version of that is apartheid in South Africa. And we could argue there is apartheid in the United States in certain places, in certain ways. There obviously has been. How do we protect against that?
Well, the only thing that I could say is through vigilance of voters. And, you know, we have to sort of try to meet the challenge to be open, I mean, to sort of be clear about what is happening here. This is really interesting to me, not just as a Black person. It's interesting to me as a scholar of the early American Republic, you know, because I've devoted my life to writing not just about slavery, but writing about the American Revolution and the formation of the government of the United States after the Revolution through American legal history classes and just early American Republic classes. And, you know, for the most part, I tell myself a story. I mean, I've been saying, well, you know, we know that there's no such thing as inevitable progress, right? That things don't have to happen any one way. History doesn't have a side. But I could look back and say, well, you know, we started out, you know, the Constitution protects slavery in ways. The Declaration wasn't applied to African-American people at the time. Jacksonian democracy was white man's government, and Black people were disfranchised during that time period. Black men were disfranchised. But then we had the war. And so secretly, even though I know that there's nothing inevitable, there is a kind of progress story there that we can tell. And it's interesting now to come to this moment and think, was that what this is all about? I mean, from where we started, when the country started in 1776, and then in the 1790s and 1800, Revolution of 1800, as Jefferson called it, or whatever, to a situation where people are talking about a president being reinstated, is just unfathomable at some level. And all I have to be optimistic that people are now sounding an alarm about this, that about the Republic, that we're in danger of losing it. So it's an issue for Black people, but it's an issue for all Americans. It's about the nature of the American Republic and, you know, what we're willing to tolerate, what we're willing to give away to try to maintain the power that you're talking about, that we're willing to accept that. Now, I do think there has been pushback and there will continue to be pushback. But right now, I can't give you any prescription to say what's going to happen. I mean, I know what has to happen is that people have to stand against this. How? I don't have a precise formula. And do I think that we're going to be successful? The people who want to maintain the American Republic are going to be successful? I like to think so. I hope so, but I can't say with 100% certainty, because so much I've been so surprised by some of the things that I've seen over the past few years that I can't come at this. I can't give you an answer that suggests that I'm 100% sure that we're going to be successful, certainly not in the short term. In the long term, I think so, because it's just so much of this is, again, this is America, and I don't want to sound like an American exceptionalist, but it's against, sometimes this strikes me so much against American character. You know, I really don't understand, you know, what's going on in a lot of ways. And so we'll just have to see.
There's so many people that are that I think know that that are going against American character. There are people mm-hmm. that know all of this, but they're swept up in the whatever, the hooey.
Yeah.
I think about what Doug High said, our friend, during our fifth anniversary show, where he said he thinks the biggest surprise in the last 5 years has been how he studied political science. And every professor would say something like, you know, this isn't permanent. This, you know, this could go away. And he just kind mm-hmm. of looked at it as perfunctory, like, got to say this because it's political science class. And now people are being hit with the reality that maybe it could go away. Mm-hmm. And that is an alarm. And hopefully we're up for the challenge.
Yeah. That's the only thing you can do is to say we're up for the challenge. And we'll stand against some of this. Because it's not, I mean, race is obviously at the center of a lot of this, and it's a problem for us, but it's an existential crisis for the country overall.
Well, we're better equipped to deal with it thanks to scholars like you. So thank you for your work.
Oh, well, you're very welcome. I don't know about that, but thank you for your work. I mean, we have our work cut out for us, I would say. Definitely.
Well, I really mean that because I just want to say that, like, there's this balance between finding all this darkness in American history and then deciding you're going to give up because it's so overwhelming. And the scholars out there who can write great books that are critical and still find love in them, those are the books that I think are inspiring. And I think that you can say it's not one or the other. It's not you swallow the whole pill and go, it's happy all the time. Everything is awesome. Like, you know, Lego Movie, obvious reference. I've got a 6-year-old. Or it's not you go, everything's terrible. You go, look, we're humans, right? There have been dark times before. We can push forward. We need examples of that. It's hard to find.
And people who were in circumstances that seem almost unimaginable, you know, hoped, you know, for something better and struggle for something better and actually make something better.
Have you gotten any feedback from family members or old friends from Texas about your book?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I have. People have been very nice about it. The advantage of this book is that it's short, you know, and people have written some very kind things to me and made contact with me and have been very, very supportive. And that's good. And heard from people that I haven't, you know, haven't been in contact with for a while. So it's good. It's all good.
Well, the book is on Juneteenth. It just came out a few weeks ago. And I'm telling you guys, it is, you'll look at it and you'll be like, this book's pretty short, and you'll start reading it and you'll be done with it before you even know. You'll be like, how did I get through it? It's wonderfully crafted. It is a stunning piece of writing, and it's been great speaking with you. Thank you for joining us, Annette Gordon-Reed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Annette.
Thank you for inviting me. A lot of fun.
Been a pleasure.
Good luck to you guys.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Take care.
Cheers. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. The Road to Now is... Hold on a second. Have you given us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts yet? Have you written a review? If not, would you please do that? It helps a lot. It helps spread the word. Helps us get the word out there. And we'd really appreciate that. Anyway, back to it. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and me, Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer and the editor of this very episode is Gary Fletcher. Our theme music today, like almost always, is by Paul DeFiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon with a special shout out to our Washingtonians, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Fig White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, T. Martin, Julia Adams, and Ann Williams and Frank Edwards. We'd also like to give a special shout out to our 2 newest supporters at the Lincoln tier, Hannah Grace Kelly and Dan Broughton. Thanks for joining us, guys. If you'd like to join us on Patreon, you can be in the Zoom room for our live recordings. You can be part of our third Thursday trivia nights. You can get bonus content. Just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you just want to go to our regular website, that's cool too. Go to theroadtonow.com. That's www.theroadtonow.com. You can search our back catalog. You can find quick links to content. You can even listen there. And you're going to wonder, why is this so good? And the answer is because it was designed by 7 Ages Design. If you're looking for a website, hit up Charles and Destiny. They're great. That's 7 Ages Design. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Thank you for listening, and take care.